hppodcraft.com.
1900 years ago from the date of this writing, a magnificently gilded and painted cangia was descending the Nile as rapidly as 50 long, flat oars, which seemed to crawl over the furrowed water like the legs of a gigantic scarabaeus, could impel it. This cangia was narrow, long, elevated at both ends in the form of a new moon, elegantly proportioned, and admirably built for speed. The figure of a ram's head, surmounted by a golden globe, armed the point of the prow, showing that the vessel belonged to some personage of royal blood.
And who is the mysterious owner of this cangia, this long, light sailboat often used on the Nile?
I can only guess it is the one and only Cleopatra.
That's right.
From the title of the story, one of Cleopatra's knights.
By Théophile Gautier. You'll recall that we covered a story of his some time ago that would have fit in perfectly with this month's theme, The Mummy's Foot.
And you're listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Here at hppodcraft.com, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. And yeah, this is the second time we've done a Gautier story. The first one we enjoyed, it was a little silly. And this one isn't as silly, but there is definitely some silly bits in it.
Yeah, it's got a sense of humor. It's written in a strange way.
It is.
As well. It was a little longer story, and I knew we only wanted to cover it in one episode, so I was worried about reading it, but once I jumped in, I really enjoyed it, and it was easy. It was an easy read.
It is an easy read. Yeah. It's very florid and lots of description, pages and pages of descriptions of things, but it's still a good story, and we should actually just talk about it.
Yeah. Théophile was a famous French writer in the mid-1800s. We kind of covered bio on him
right
before.
We did.
He wrote criticism as well as dramas and stories, and yeah, when we were covering him, I said he was a dance critic, meaning ballet, but you thought that meant that he went to clubs and was just really bitchy about
I still think that. You haven't changed my mind.
Lovecraft liked Gautier quite a lot, this story in particular, and here's what he had to say about it.
The Egyptian visions invoked in One of Cleopatra's Knights are of the keenest and most expressive potency. Gautier captured the inmost soul of aeon-weighed Egypt, with its cryptic life in cyclopean architecture, and uttered once and for all the eternal horror of its netherworld of catacombs, where to the end of time, millions of stiff, spiced corpses will stare up in the blackness with glassy eyes, awaiting some awesome and unrelatable summons.
So if that's what he thought of the story, you can definitely see why it appealed to him. I do think all that stuff's in here in the descriptions. They really, before we jumped on here, you were saying there's no mummies in this story.
Technically, there's no mummies in this story.
Especially not in the reanimated mummy that goes out and clocks people and then runs away.
Or picks them up and throws them in water.
Yeah, none of that stuff. But in the way that Egypt itself is described in the beginning, it's as if the entire country is a mummy. And there's some description that I'll point
yes
to that supports that. I say let's think of it in terms of Egypt as a mummy that this young, vibrant queen has to deal with. I want to thank our reader that we heard at the beginning there, Melissa Hearn.
Yeah.
Quick background on this story. It was first published as a six-part serial in 1838 in La Presse. The story was translated into English together with other fantastic tales of Gautier by Lafcadio Hearn. I believe Lafcadio is the correct pronunciation, but I'm not sure.
Oui.
For the collection One of Cleopatra's Knights and Other Fantastic Romances, which was published in 1882. So that's the translation that we're reading. But as you were saying, this is a very sumptuously written story, very expressive, kind of a word painting. So maybe we should just try and get through the bones of it.
I just want people, when we're going through this and the bits when we read them, think of Lovecraft, because when I read the story, it really seemed like the type of thing Lovecraft was trying to emulate
yeah
in his very florid descriptions of places and things. This definitely seems like a point of inspiration.
Definitely. Something that he tried to do, but maybe not quite as well as Gautier.
Not that I'm going to be coming down on Lovecraft. I'm just saying, this is pretty solid stuff. This writing here is pretty top-notch.
Definitely. So, as we heard in the beginning, we have this long boat that's being propelled by all these oars, who are obviously slaves of some kind.
Yes.
Making this thing just motor down the Nile. This is all description of everything about this ship is described.
Just the way it looks, the way it's built, the way it moves. Mm-hmm. They go into a long, there's a whole paragraph just devoted to the description of the captain. They give a long description of the sun in the sky. They go into a description of the shores of the Nile. Talk about how it has like a really arid sadness to it.
You get this feeling that it's just hot and it stasis here. Nothing's moving.
Yeah.
Without melancholy, without reverie, without one pearly gray cloud to follow toward the horizon, one secret spring wherein to lave one's dusty feet, the sadness of a sphinx weary of eternally gazing upon the desert and unable to detach herself from the granite upon which she has sharpened her claws for 20 centuries. It's just a dead land.
Yeah.
This is a great way to start a romance, because any great romance starts with a kind of feeling of stasis. If things don't change, I'm going to die too.
Yeah.
It's just a really kind of nice place to start the story. We go through all of this description of the silence and the landscape, and then we pull into the boat to see who's inside the chamber.
Upon this strange pillow reposed a most charming head, one look of which once caused the loss of half a world. An adorable, a divine head. The head of the most perfect woman that ever lived. The most womanly and most queenly of all women. An admirable type of beauty which the imagination of poets could never invest with any new grace, and which dreamers will find forever in the depths of their dreams. It is not necessary to name Cleopatra.
Well, not necessary, but you just did it.
Trying to be clever about it.
Cleopatra is almost like Dracula or something now, honestly. It's a historical figure that's real, but she's become a Halloween costume.
Yeah.
It's kind of just a character that everybody knows, but what do we really know about Cleopatra?
Well, she's not Egyptian, she's Greek.
Right, that family that she's from. She was Cleopatra VII and the Ptolemy family, so it was like an old Greek family that just ruled Egypt.
They were made pharaohs. I mean, they were divine.
Right.
She had to marry her younger brother when her father died, who was Ptolemy the 12th. He died Ptolemy the 13th, which is her younger brother. He was 10 and she was 18, and they were made co-monarchs.
Right.
They got married because that's what they do. I mean, he's 10, so I don't know. I think it's just kind of entitled they were married, I hope.
Right. Well, she married both of her brothers.
Well, yeah, hold on. I'll get to that. So she married her younger brother, and then she just kind of steamrolled him and just took over because he's 10, you know, and she's 18 and she's a powerful woman and she knows what she's doing. She kind of had a bit of bad luck because according to the records and things, they just had famine. There was a drought and lots of things, economic failures as well.
She had a bad time to be the ruler.
She ticked off some people. I'm not going to go into that because that's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
She ticked off some people. They got mad at her and staged a bit of a coup, and she got kicked out. And so her brother became the sole ruler.
Yeah.
So that's when Pompey and all the stuff was going on with Caesar.
Right. Over in Rome.
Julius Caesar in Rome. So Pompey was leaving because that's when Julius Caesar came in to take over Rome. And Pompey was one of the triumvirates that was in control of Rome at the time.
Yeah.
But when Julius Caesar took over, he made himself emperor, and Pompey ran off. And when he got there, Ptolemy the 13th was like, oh man, this guy, we got him, killed him, chopped off his head, and was like, hey, Julius Caesar, we're your buds, check this out, we got this guy for you. And Caesar was totally angry because even though they were fighting, he was family to him.
Yeah.
And he didn't want him dead.
Right.
He just didn't want him in charge. He was so angry that he was just going to annex all of Egypt. Cleopatra saw her opening, and you might have heard about this, where she was wrapped up in a rug and brought into Julius Caesar.
Yes.
And she said, hey, check it out. I'm actually co-ruler, but I got handled. And if you back me, I'll rule for you. And I will also do some naughtiness with you because I'm hot.
Exactly.
And all that happened. And she got pregnant with his son, who was Ptolemy Caesar, which was nicknamed Caesarion.
Yes.
Which means little Caesar.
He was the one that created crazy bread.
Which is delicious.
But wait a minute. What happened to the first brother then?
He was just kind of pushed out and then accidentally drowned, quote unquote, accidentally drowned.
I smell a mummy attack.
She had to bury her even younger brother, Ptolemy the 14th.
Right.
So he was her co-ruler because they have to have this whole brother, sister. I think it comes from Isis and Osiris because I think they were also brother and sister, and they were also husband and wife.
Ancient civilizations had some odd customs.
They, yeah, you know, who might have judged?
Well, then she was sole ruler because this brother went away as well.
Yeah, he died soon after. It is assumed he was poisoned and was replaced by Caesarion to be the co-ruler with Cleopatra. While this was going on, Rome was having a new civil war because Caesar was assassinated. Mark Antony and Octavius were on one side of it, and it was, you know, Brutus and all those other guys were on the other, and so there was a lot of fighting going on. She supported them because of her connection with Caesar, being that he was the father of her son. When Antony got there, then, you know, she turned on the charm again and got him all sexed up and had some kids with him. He went back to Rome. Octavius had him marry his sister because he wanted to lock it in. He didn't like Octavius's sister, so he left and went back to Cleopatra. I'm trying to make this much shorter because this is a long story here. He went back with her and basically try to take over Egypt and have their own empire. And she kind of filled him with like, oh, you could beat Octavius. You're the real ruler, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's how I'm seeing into it, at least. And and of course, Octavius is awesome, totally beats them down. Mark Antony dies first. He wigged out at the end and was going to kill her. She locked herself in. This is all according to Plutarch. So Mark Antony was going to kill her. He was totally angry. And then this, I mean, this is the craziest. This can't be true. It's just all too crazy. So she tells her servants to tell him that she poisoned herself and she's dead. He believes it, freaks out, stabs himself in the gut, but doesn't kill himself. And then he's just dying. And then he tries to get anybody and everybody around there to kill him, but nobody will do it because it's Mark Antony.
Yeah.
Cleopatra hears about this, but she still doesn't trust him because she thinks he's totally nuts, which he is. Mm-hmm. And so she has him tied. She's still up in this place, sealed off. So she says she'll throw down some rope and they'll tie him up on the rope, tie him up, and then she'll pull him up through the window. What? So she pulls him up through the window, sees that he actually is dying and is bleeding out. She starts freaking out and crying. He tells her to calm down and get him a glass of wine. Mm-hmm. And so she gets him some wine, he drinks the wine, and then he dies. And that's it. And then, of course, she was captured by Octavius. Mm. He wanted to parade her around, and then she supposedly got the asp and killed herself.
Okay, well, that's a little different than how I know the story. That's interesting.
You're probably thinking of Shakespeare's.
I am, yeah, right. Yeah. Obviously, I read that in college, and that's sort of how it is in my head.
Yeah, that makes sense. So Caesarion was left being the sole pharaoh, but he was killed off as well.
Yeah.
That ended the Ptolemaic line.
So he was the last of the pharaohs.
Yeah.
I mean, she was the last to actually be ruling as pharaoh because Caesarion didn't really get very far in his rule.
No.
So really, we consider Cleopatra the last of the pharaohs.
Yeah.
I don't know much about it, but there's always been debate about what she actually looked like. And standards of beauty at the time, I think, were quite different than they are now.
Sure.
In my head, you know, I think Liz Taylor, I guess.
Could be. I mean, she's Greek, so...
Well, when Théophile describes Cleopatra here, it's really overboard. I mean, she is perfect.
Yeah.
It feels to me like when you first are... you know, growing up and discovering love, do you remember that feeling you would have, like there's somebody out there that's perfect for you, and
you
kind of just idealize them in your head, and and this is how he's writing about her. I mean, it is so overboard. She's still in this Egyptian ceremonial costume. She's returning from a festival. Right now, the people in Cleopatra's family would not learn Egyptian.
No,
they would only speak Greek, but Cleopatra did learn Egyptian.
Yeah.
She considered herself a reincarnation of the goddess Isis. She was definitely, the people liked her. Anyway, he goes on and on and on about what she's wearing, what she looks like, how her hair is, all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they also introduce her personal slave, right? Carmion?
Mm-hmm. Historically, she killed herself with Cleopatra when she died.
Right.
She also took poison. And that's another thing. Historically, nobody's really sure. I think that the asp thing might be a myth because the way they describe her death and her body, an asp bite, it's a paralytic and it does stuff to your eyes and it makes you all, it's a painful way to go. They think that she might have actually just had some kind of poison.
Basically, we've gotten this description of how hot and still and static all of Egypt is. And Cleopatra is here in her chamber with her servant and she's saying, it is so hot. I am so bored of this drought. I'm weary unto death. She is experiencing the deepest level of ennui that one can experience.
And that ends the first chapter.
So when she gets into chapter two, she talks about Egypt. And I think this goes to what you were saying, that Lovecraft was trying to make an attempt at some of this type of language.
Yeah.
And also to what I was saying about Egypt being a mummy. This is what she says about Egypt.
I would give a pearl for one drop of rain. From the inflamed pupil of that sky of bronze, no tear has ever yet fallen upon the desolation of this land. It is only a vast covering for a tomb. The dome of a necropolis. The sky dead and dried up like the mummies it hangs over. This land is truly an awful land. All things in it are gloomy, enigmatic, incomprehensible. Imagination has produced in it only monstrous chimeras and monuments immeasurable. This architecture and this art fill me with fear. Those colossi, whose stone-entangled limbs compel them to remain eternally sitting with their hands upon their knees, weary me with their stupid immobility. When, indeed, shall the giant come who is to take them by the hand and relieve them from their long watch of 20 centuries? Of what master, then, do they await the coming, to leave their mountain seats and rise in token of respect? Of what invisible flock are those huge sphinxes, the guardians, crouching like dogs on the watch, that they never close their eyelids and forever extend their claws in readiness to seize. Why are their stony eyes so obstinately fixed upon eternity and infinity? What weird secret do their firmly locked lips retain within their breasts? On the right hand, on the left, whithersoever one turns, only frightful monsters are visible. Dogs with the heads of men, men with the heads of dogs, chimeras begotten of hideous couplings in the shadowy depths of the labyrinths, partridges with great yellow eyes that seem to pierce through you with their inquisitorial gaze and see beyond and behind you things which one dare not speak of. A family of animals and horrible gods with scaly wings, hooked beaks, trenchant claws, ever ready to seize and devour you should you venture to cross the threshold of the temple or lift a corner of the veil.
Wow.
That to me is so Lovecraftian.
I agree.
She talks a long time about how terribly, terribly, terribly bored she is and how this is not a great place, Egypt, for a young woman to be hanging out.
Yeah, that this whole place is just a big cemetery.
Yeah.
Where other lands are about life, everybody in Egypt is focused around the dead. I think she says, it is said that the living have no other occupation than that of preserving the dead.
That's all they do is just make mummies all day. Making mummies, making mummies, making mummies.
It's mummy time.
Carmian says to herself, it's easy to be seen that the queen has not had a lover nor has killed anyone for a whole month.
Yeah.
Cleopatra is cruel. You know, I think at one point she says, I'm so bored. I've already tried out all of my poisons on slaves and watched them die. That's how she gets her kicks.
She is not a good person.
No, no.
And it's really interesting in the story because Cotier really makes fun of her a lot. And I mean, as we go, there's more of it. How kind of over the top and ridiculous she is.
So over the top. I see you made a note about Carmian tickles her feet to get her to go to sleep.
Yeah. What's that about?
She tickles the soles of her feet gently with a peacock's feather. I don't know. How could that make you go to sleep? I'd kick her in the face accidentally.
I don't get it.
Well, she goes off to sleep and then we pull out to this boat that's coming in because she's about home. Gigantic palace that she lives in. Outside of that, we see this handsome young guy that's about 20. Says he's got hair so black that it seems to own a tinge of blue. So he kind of's got a Superman
thing going, yeah.
He's rowing a tiny little boat.
Yeah, following along.
And then we get into chapter 3. This is where we learn more about who this guy is.
And he is, and I don't know how to pronounce his name because they have an umlaut over an I. Chad, do you know how an umlaut over an I is pronounced?
I don't know how this name is pronounced, but I'm going to say Mayamun.
Mayamun. They go into how he is a really handsome dude and he's really strong.
Although owning a grace of form almost maidenly in its delicacy, beneath the soft exterior were hidden sinews of steel and the strength of Hercules. So he's both beautiful, but strong. He's not coming off like this big, you know what I mean? He's like a...
He's not a Hulk kind of guy.
One thing they say about Mayamun is the abyss called him. And what that means is he just goes after things that are so dangerous.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that really interests him, right? He hunts great cats and things that could easily kill him.
Crocodiles and hippopotamuses and all the dangerous animals, he goes after them, almost like he's craving death, but none of it really satisfies him.
But this is his nature, and it explains why... We find out he is in love with Cleopatra.
Not because he's actually hung out with her or talked to her or had a conversation. He's just seen her and he's fallen in love with her.
He's just one of the people out in the crowd, but he has decided against his own wishes even. You know, he prays to the gods, why am I stricken with this? But when there's gorgeous chicks that want to get with him, right? They describe that. There's a lot of ladies that he could be having, but he needs and wants Cleopatra. Can't fight it. And I was on his side about that, but you know.
We can't fight love, dude.
If you back out, though, and you think about it, it's a little more like, I'm going to shoot the president so Jody knows I love her. You know what I mean?
Oh,
he's actually like a celebrity stalker. He doesn't know Cleopatra.
He is a celebrity stalker completely.
But he's determined he's going to get in somehow. So he's following this boat. He's not sure what to do. We pull back in. Cleopatra's in there with Carmian. And suddenly this arrow flies through the window. Buries itself in the wall. Cleopatra's scared to death. Carmian grabs it.
There's a note on it.
And it says, I love you. So that was his plan.
Good plan.
We get into chapter 4. Actually, the plan kind of worked.
Well, it does because Cleopatra is into this. She's like, whoa, somebody loves me?
Yeah.
This is exciting because she talks about how she wants love, but nobody can really love her because she is Cleopatra.
Right.
This guy, maybe he's got something going on, but she doesn't know what to do. So she says, whoever shot this arrow, send out the boat guys and go have them search around the palace and see if they can find him. The boat guys go out, try to find him. They can't. He comes back and says, I'm sorry, I couldn't find him. And Cleopatra is so mad that she's going to either have him put into hard labor, this guy that couldn't find a dude, like 20 minutes after the fact, or have him killed. Carmian says, hey, don't worry about it. We'll take care of this. And then there's this long, like it's a page or two, because Cleopatra's really indignant about the fact that her wishes aren't being fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on for like 2 pages about how awesome she is and how everybody should do all these things and examples of how they basically kiss her ass 24/7.
Yeah.
It's really bizarre.
It is.
In this story, because it makes her, it really paints her out to be a really lame person.
It does. It does. But it's also making a contrary point, which is that the world has not seen the like of this kind of wealth and power since.
Yeah.
Which he goes to talk about quite a bit more later. She's an absurd character, definitely. I mean, she's never had anything not done that she wanted. And this is part of the thing that's becoming, making this whole situation more attractive to her, because she's not used to being denied. Now, she names some guys she thinks that might be doing it, but Carmian says, get out of here.
Because those guys don't love you. They want you because of your position of power. But this is obviously an action of somebody that's completely infatuated with you.
Yeah.
So she's like, oh, all right. Interesting. But what are we going
to
do?
Then we get back to Maemoon. It says, terrified at his own hardihood. Maemoon had thrown himself into the Nile. Oh, my God, I'm so hardy. Make it stop. Terrified. But he had run away because obviously he was freaked out by what he'd done. They didn't find him. He thinks about it and says, you know what? This was a good idea.
Yeah, because he has this interesting philosophy. He's saying in the eyes of a god, because that's how he sees her, a slave and a monarch are equal. They're just below her. They're just nothing.
Yeah.
So if she's going to get hooked up with some Roman guy, why not him?
Makes sense. So he turns around, he swims back to the palace, and he actually dives underwater where he sees an archway. And this is one of the aqueducts that leads to the baths within the palace. So he swims underwater to get into the baths of Cleopatra. And it's when we go on to the next chapter where Cleopatra wakes up and is going to be bathed.
And this is some really funny stuff, too, because she wakes up and she's just in it. Oh, she couldn't sleep because she's been thinking about this guy and who he is and what's going on with it. And she's just been obsessed with it. So it says, in a faint voice, like that of a sick child, Cleopatra asks to be lifted out of bed. And they do. They pick her up and they put her down on a tiger skin rug. And then they just like kind of rub her and make her feel nice and tell her she's awesome. And oh my God.
And she had slept with her feet up. Carmian sleeps at the foot of her bed so she can rest her feet on her favorite slave too.
Yeah.
I mean, this is everything. One of the things doesn't say when they go down to the baths, she actually walks on her own. It says she had taken at least 30 steps all by herself.
Yeah.
Mighty effort. Enormous fatigue.
Yeah.
And you're right. He's making fun of her. He's trying to impress you with it. At the same time, I think he's winking.
It's definitely.
So she gets down there. She's scrubbing up. She's showing off. She's swimming around. He's talking about how.
Well, it gets a little sexy. It gets a little sexy here. Yeah. This description stuff is a little hot here. I just have it unbuttoned my top button.
Wait, what?
On my shirt, Chad.
Because you were getting warm. Hot.
I was getting warm.
She swims to and fro. She brings up handfuls of gold dust with which she laughingly pelted some of her women.
Yeah.
Which means that I have to hear Criswell say this.
Throw gold at her. More gold.
That's another clip from Orgy of the Dead. Which, by the way, I'm going to play more Wolfman and Mummy at the end of this episode. I don't even care if we go long. I'm going to.
Oh my gosh, it's so good.
She suddenly sees, because Maemoon's gotten up out of the water and he's hiding over in the bushes checking her out while she swims around. And then Cleopatra catches him.
Freaks out. All the eunuchs come in and they grab him and they're getting ready to just kill him. She goes, wait, not yet. So what Roman assassin sent you?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, baby, no, nobody sent me. You are a goddess and I would never have an evil thought against you.
If you were mine, I'd treat you like a princess. I'm Cleopatra.
I don't have any shortage of people treating me like a princess.
I only took 30 steps today. She actually carries around a pedometer to prove it to people. Look at that. 2.
He tells her that he loves her and she recognizes him. She goes, wait, I've seen you around. You followed me at all these different. And at that festival, you stood out to me. I have to punish you. I have to kill you because of what you've done.
Yeah.
And she just kind of teases him a bit and she plays with him. She says she's going to spare his life. And she decides that she's going to do an experiment.
I'm going to bring you up to my heights for one night. It's kind of like you just happen to meet Madonna and she's like, check it out.
Yeah.
You're going on tour with me tonight, which I know was a big dream of yours for a long time.
Oh my God, yeah.
When you used to write her those letters. You were a lot like Maemoon.
I'm still writing those letters.
You have indulged yourself in wild and extravagant dreams. In fancy, your desires have crossed an impassable threshold. You imagined yourself to be Caesar or Mark Antony. You left the queen. In some moment of delirium, you have been able to believe that, under some condition of things which take place but once in 1,000 years, Cleopatra might someday love you. Well, what you thought impossible is actually about to happen. I will transform your dream into a reality. It pleases me, for once, to secure the accomplishment of a mad hope. I am willing to inundate you with glories and splendors and lightnings. I intend that your good fortune shall be dazzling in its brilliancy. You were at the bottom of the ladder. I am about to lift you to the summit. Abruptly, suddenly, without a transition, I take you out of nothingness. I make you the equal of a god, and I plunge you back again into nothingness. That is all.
So that's the plan.
Yeah, it's kind of a Trading Places sort of thing, almost.
That's exactly what it is. Gets us into the chapter 6. This is where I think Gautier really out loud says what the theme of this story is, or what it's about, or what he's trying to hint at, which is that in the modern world, we don't ever see anything like the spectacles of the ancient world.
Right.
And a lot of the time that he spent describing the servants and all of the buildings and everything is just to really impress you with that. And he says, you know, you might think, how did people put up with these rulers creating these gigantic structures and subjugating so many people? And he's saying it was because those prodigious lives were the realizations by day of the dreams which haunted each man by night. In other words, you know, these spectacles were so impressive that people just snapped into place.
Yeah.
And the fact that we've removed them all now has made the world irredeemably and hopelessly dull. And it made me think of, you know, not the most brilliant thought, but it made me think of Nazi Germany.
Right.
We often go, how did all of those people just fall into line like that? But when you see the spectacle of it, the people in lockstep and the gigantic, all of those people, it's really, I think it just swept everybody up, you know?
Yeah. On a much smaller scale, too. It happens, I think, still today. In England, we've got a royal family. Mm-hmm. You know, that's people kind of are really interested in what happens with Kate and William and,
right.
and baby George and all that stuff. And any celebrity culture, it's the same thing. Now, the gap between the lowest and the highest is much smaller than it was in these times,
yeah.
you know, where there were slaves, you know, there was a huge portion of the population that were just slaves. It's a little bit different, but, you know, I think trading up no slaves for not as much grandeur, I think it's pretty...
That's fine with me.
It's a good swap.
Yeah. I know the world's a little more dull, but I'm just happy at least I can make some money in it and rent an apartment.
And you don't have to worry about being enslaved at any point.
Exactly. Cut to the chase. He has an amazing night with Cleopatra.
Yeah, well, it starts off, things get hot, dude.
Yeah.
It is a task to describe a supreme orgy.
Yeah.
He can't really go into too much detail about what goes on, but it is pretty crazy. Now, I'm not sure, does he actually participate in this orgy or does he just kind of hang out and watch? Because that's the impression that I got reading the story.
Well, I wasn't sure if it was a literal orgy the way we think of it or if it was just orgiastic in the proportions of things. I mean, I don't know if he's like describing the banquets and the pleasures and the entertainments. I mean, obviously there's some sexual content.
Yeah.
But I think the orgy is everything. I mean, it's any, you know, wine and there's probably, you know, people are doing a few bumps and like heroin and they're freebasing over here and then somebody's banging somebody over here. And yeah, you can jump in on that if you want to, or just go eat a whole steak, you know, or whatever. That's what's happening here. I don't know how they can participate in all of it.
Sure.
There's so much. And he's dressed like he's a pharaoh, you know, he's out there with her. And then she breakdances for him a little bit, I think, right?
Well, she's not breakdancing. It's as the night goes on, she does a kind of a sexy dance for him.
Yeah, that's kind of the culmination of the whole thing. After all of this craziness for his senses and all the people that try and give him this wild night, she gets up and she grooves it for him and does a little sexy belly dance, and it's amazing.
He's totally into it. And she kisses him on the head, on the forehead.
Right.
Which I was like, oh man, this doesn't go where I was hoping it was going.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's an Egyptian euphemism, you know?
You know what? I'll decide that it is.
Yeah, sure. And then day is coming. Looks like this night is going to have to come to an end. And Maimoun is resigned to his fate.
He's got some poison. He's ready to drink it. He's like, you know what? I've had the best night of my life. This is it. It's not going to get any better than this.
Cleopatra turned pale and laid her hand on Maimoun's arm to stay the act. His courage touched her. She was about to say, "Live to love me yet. I desire it." When the sound of a clarion was heard, 4 heralds at arms entered the banquet hall on horseback. They were the officers of Mark Antony and rode but a short distance in advance of their master. Cleopatra silently loosened the arm of Maimoune. A long ray of sunlight suddenly played upon her forehead, as though trying to replace her absent diadem.
"You see, the moment has come. It is daybreak. It is the hour when happy dreams take flight," said Maimoune.
Then he emptied the fatal vessel at a draught and fell as though struck by lightning. Cleopatra bent her head, and one burning tear, the only one she had ever shed, fell into her cup to mingle with the molten pearl.
"By Hercules, my fair queen, I made all speed in vain. I see I have come too late," cried Mark Antony, entering the banquet hall. "The supper is over, but what signifies this corpse upon the pavement?"
"Oh, nothing," returned Cleopatra with a smile. "Only a poison I was testing with the idea of using it upon myself, should Augustus take me prisoner. My dear lord, will you not please to take a seat beside me and watch those Greek buffoons dance?"
Aww.
And that's the end.
That's the end. Rather tragic and sad.
You get the sense that she really, maybe in that moment, loved him, but...
Yeah.
Such as the fickleness of a queen.
Just like anybody, she wants acceptance, and she wants to be loved for who she is, and
yeah.
She's thinking maybe this is the first time that somebody's actually, he loves me for who I am.
Yeah.
And that's why she wanted to have him stick around. Eventually, she would have got bored with him and
she
killed
would've.
Him, but
sure.
It's probably the best way for him.
I mean, that's what happens, unfortunately, as human beings, no matter how much you get used to it.
Sure.
I mean, there's obviously, when you raise, there's a poverty level where you know, money will make you happier.
Oh, right, yeah.
To
yeah.
a point.
Yes.
But after that, I mean, happiness is so, even her, you know, she's got everything that anybody could possibly ever want and still, eh.
You can't take it with you, Pfeiffer.
That's true.
The Egyptians thought you could.
The Egyptians really did think you could take it with you. I read a whole article about how they mummified not only pets and servants with some of these noblemen, but they also mummified huge amounts of food.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. They find mummified meat. The famous pharaoh, King Tutankhamun, went to his final resting place accompanied by 48 cases of beef and poultry.
What?
Yeah.
That is ridiculous. That doesn't, and also it doesn't make any sense because, like, I can understand there's some kind of symbolic piece of meat that would be sitting next to you. Okay, that makes sense to me. It's like the spiritualness of the meat can sustain you, but that much meat kind of implies that he's actually needs to eat a bunch of meat.
Yeah.
And then eventually that's going to run out.
I don't understand why they did it, but
it's crazy.
Well, you know what? That sounds like something maybe we should talk about on if we did, let's say, like a month on ghosts, because then we can maybe decide whether ghosts need to eat or not.
Talk about the other side, the afterlife.
I mean, I hate to say it, but Mummy Madness Month is drawing to a close.
Oh, it has, hasn't it?
There is more mummification stuff we could talk about and probably will in the future, but for now we have to say goodbye.
Goodbye, Emus April.
And then we're going to move on to a new month of ghost stories.
Ghost May?
Well, I don't know what we're going to call it yet. So if people have any ideas, but we're definitely talking ghosts. We're talking the afterlife. We're talking hauntings in May as part of Monster Party 2014. Ghosts are very important to the Monster Party.
Oh my gosh, of course.
Yeah. So what we're going to start with is a story called Mrs. Lunt by Hugh Walpole, whom we haven't covered on the show yet. That's going to be our first story
for
the first free show of May in our ghostly haunting month, whatever we're going to call it. Please write in and let us know what you think.
I want to thank our reader.
I want to thank our reader once again. Melissa Hearn did a fantastic job with a lot of very flowy language.
Great job. Outstanding stuff.
And hopefully we'll have you back again.
And I just want to say thank you for listening and thank you for subscribing because this is a subscriber-only show.
Yeah, we love you. Really appreciate it.
You guys are great. So next week, free show, Mrs. Lunt by Hugh Walpole. And I am Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.
I don't like snakes. I remember the one Cleopatra used. Cute little rascal until it flicked out that red tongue and those two sharp fangs. You'd never think such a little thing packed such a big wallop. Ah, hurt her? Hell, it killed her.